The Senate Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. It's Tuesday, March 20th. Senator Latz. We put, people will remember that last Thursday, Senator Latz, I think, withdrew Senate File 1333 to continue to work on it. And Senator Latz, we've given you 10 minutes. I don't want to tell you that 15 are used up, but that's not your fault. That's not your fault. You were in here when I was. So I appreciate that. And what do you have to tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to come back before you. Since we last met, I have been working with a number of the interested parties in this bill to try to reach an agreement, we have done so. And I would like to describe that to you briefly and then allow them to make a few comments and stand for any questions that you might have. Probably the best way to do this is to get the bill into the shape I'd like it to move forward. And so I would ask if the chair or someone would move the A8 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd move the A8 amendment.
Senator Scogin moves the A8 amendment. Do you want to describe that for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. First, there would be an addition, an oral amendment to the A8 amendment. I would request to delete lines 1.27 through line 1.32.
Senator Scogin adds that to his amendment. We are deleting 1.27 through 1.32. Is that correct?
You.
Senator
yes.
Latz.
Madam Chair, this amendment would delete entirely the provisions in the engrossed bill that pertain to disclosure of any markups in the financing rate that occurs between what the bank or GMAC, the lending institution, would charge and what the dealer would pass on to the buyer. So if the dealer were to mark up a 4% interest rate to, say, 5.5% and take a portion of that for the dealer's own compensation, that they would not have to make any disclosures of that.
So Senator Latz, the original bill had the cap, and then you went to the disclosure. Now this is deleting any reference
correct
to that spread.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Secondly, this amendment would delete the provision in the original bill to disclose the credit score to the buyer and would replace it with a requirement that there be a disclosure that a consumer report was used, a consumer credit report was used in determining the financing terms and explain to the buyer, the borrower in this case, where they may obtain further information about the details of their own credit report.
Senator Latz, my question is on lines 121 and 22 of the A8 amendment. Is that phone number and that website, are those government numbers or titles? Is that?
I'd have to defer to counsel.
Is that a particular credit reporting agency? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act required that the consumer reporting agencies do this, and so they have kind of put together a, for want of a better term, a joint venture to operate this website and this and toll-free number to kind of, there's three basic consumer reporting agencies, and they all can be accessed through these, through the number and the website.
Mr. Stang, thank you.
Madam Chair, there is, with regard to this provision, there's one little bit that I still need to work on. I'm not going to try to do it in front of this committee, but I will clean it up after this, and that has to do with line 1.6, where it refers to a retail seller that obtains a consumer report. And it's not clear that every dealer actually obtains a credit report. The bank or GMAC might actually retain or obtain the credit report. And so I need to find some language in there to tweak that, but I'm not going to try to do that in front of the committee.
Senator Latz, something to the effect of when a consumer report from a consumer reporting agency has been requested or obtained, that kind of thing. You don't need to do that.
Actually, I like that language, and I would ask that it be written into this amendment.
I'll make that part of my amendment.
Well, let's see if
what did you say?
you know me with my short-term memory here. When a consumer report from a consumer reporting agency has been obtained for use in connection with an application. So you would delete a retail seller that obtains, and then you would say when, and then leave a consumer report from a consumer reporting agency has been obtained. Does that work, Mr. Stang? No.
I think we need to provide the document. The retail seller shall provide.
Is that
on line 1.8 after vehicle?
To make that sentence work, Senator Latz, does that make sense?
No, it's
Mr. Stang, why don't you read? Can you read that whole?
Madam Chair, I would read when a consumer report from a consumer reporting agency has been obtained for use in connection with an application for credit initiated by a buyer for the purchase or lease of a motor vehicle, the retail seller shall provide, comma, and then it continues on.
Madam Chair, that gets us most of the way there. I think we might have a little cleanup to do afterward, but I'm prepared to work on that at a different...
But that's your intent, Senator Latz. So yes. that would be added to the Scogin offering here of your amendment. Anything else?
Thank you. There are a couple of other provisions. You may recall that the gentleman from CarMax testified with regard to a couple of details at the last hearing, and he suggested some language that we've incorporated into this as well. One specifically defines the reference to the trade-in value of a vehicle and removes fair market value from any reference point. When a refund is made, it will just refer to the actual value of the trade-in vehicle contained in the sales contract. It provides a few delays in the reimbursement or the refund to account for a weekend issue and also to account for the time necessary for a check to clear. A check from a buyer to clear, so they actually have funds that they can refund. And let's see here. I think that is, and in the subsequent amendment, there'll be another amendment to this in which we delay the effective date to January 1, 2008 to give the dealers and everyone interested time to accommodate their administrative process.
You have that in a separate amendment.
I have it in the A10 amendment, which will come next.
Is there any discussion on this? I'd like to hear Ms. Schlander or... No. Okay. Yes, Mr. Tennyson.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to clarify something.
And just identify yourself.
I'm Bob Tennyson. I'm law firm Great Plains Moody, and I represent CarMax. With the deletion from A8 of the lines 1.27 through 1.32 that dealt with the negative equity issue, is that that's being replaced with?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that will be replaced with the A10 amendment, lines 1.7 to 1.12. Okay. It covers all of that, but it also covers then with the situation where the trade-in vehicle is not sold before the other vehicles return. It's actually still on the lot.
Yeah, because we were concerned about the negative equity when the negative equity is rolled into a new loan. So
that's still covered.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schlander.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Schlander with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I'm just here to say Senator Latz has been gracious enough to work with us and resolve most of our concerns with this bill. With the 8-8 and the 8-10 amendment, the bill is workable in the real world. So I thank Senator Latz for the accommodation.
Schlander, and thank you for working with Senator Latz. And Senator Latz, then, and members on the Scogin Amendment, it's the A8 amendment with the change up on Section 6 and then also delete the oral piece of that, deleting 127 through 132. Any discussion on this amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Letts, you have an A-10 amendment?
I do. I asked someone to offer A-10 amendment, and I have one oral amendment to that as well, which would be to delete line 1.4.
Madam Chair, I'd move amendment 10.
Senator Scogin moves the A-10 amendment. Senator Letts, did you want to change something on this?
Yes, delete line 1.4, please.
Delete that line.
1.4?
Yes.
Just delete that. So we have the issue here that Mr. Tennyson was concerned about on line 1.7 to 112. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is also changes the effective date. Well, that's basically what it does. We're deleting line 1.4 because we did some research on the price of rental vehicles and found that there's a significant enough gap between what it would cost to rent a vehicle and what it would cost to buy and return a used car, that there won't be any financial incentive for someone to buy and return a used car. Now checking the Auto Dealers Association's agreement that the original number in the bill is fine.
Okay. Is there any discussion on this amendment, members? On the Scogin motion, then, on the A-10 amendment without line 1.4. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, I have nothing further except I'd ask for the committee's support based on today.
Is there any discussion here? Is there a motion?
Go ahead.
Senator Olson, Senator Scogin.
I defer.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, I'd be happy then to move Senate file.
Which file are we on? 1333
as amended, be recommended to pass.
And referred, it will go to the floor. On that motion, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to the bill, for or against? Seeing no one coming forth, no further discussion on that motion. Committee, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Letts, thank you for keeping going and working.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You have something important to...
And thank you for the input of all the committee members as I try to find consensus on the bill.
And now, looking at tonight's agenda, Senator Clark.
Afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Senator Clark.
Thank you very much for taking the time today. I think I've got a few people who are supposed to be joining me.
And Senator Clark, I'd like this to be like an hour in total.
Like it to be too, Madam
okay.
Chair. That sounds good.
Yeah, let's try to do that. And so those people who are preparing to testify, and I'm going to ask in particular if there's repetition to not engage in any repeating of something somebody else has already said. I know the committee is going to be listening intently, and we'll just try to keep it brief. I don't want to put a limit on people, but I really don't want anybody going on for 5-10 minutes. So
Madam Chair, what I'm
but
hearing,
Senator Clark, you may
yes.
in explaining your bill.
Well, good, because hopefully I won't be redundant yet. Madam Chair and members, we do have a delete everything amendment, and it might make sense to start with that before I go through the bill. I don't know if that's been passed out to members or not.
Does someone have the amendment? Senator Marty.
I'll move it. I don't have it.
I don't have it.
We don't have it.
We don't have it.
Senator Marty, do you have copies for us?
I do not have copies, no. I'm saying I would like one.
Looks like they're finding it. I don't know.
Good stuff.
Jesus. I forgot that one. Thanks.
You do have copies?
It looks like I do, Madam Chair. Okay. I thought actually they'd already given it to your staff, so sorry about that.
See it, and then we're gonna make some more copies if that's all right. I'll let you look at it.
Madam Chair, there is one oral amendment to the amendment. I don't know if you want to wait until it's been passed out. It's a word change.
Why don't you tell me, and then we'll go over it again when
on line 2.12, it says health plan.
Yes.
The word plan should be deleted and carrier should be inserted.
Insert carrier for plan.
Right. The intent was not to have the health carriers be impacted by this. And that's a broader term than plan.
Okay. I'm going to wait till members have it in front of them.
Sounds good.
Hey, since everybody's here, members, we will be getting together again at 6 o'clock tonight. Let me tell you what we're planning to do. We're going to start with testimony regarding a couple of the predatory lending bills. Senator Higgins is carrying the Attorney General's bills that we'll be starting those at 6 o'clock. She's not going to present her bill this afternoon. She's going to do that this evening. And then we're going to entertain amendments. And I know I have a bill. I will have amendments for it, but I'm hopefully going to have time to explain the bill this afternoon, and we'll do amendments this evening. But it's our intention to pass any or all of the bills out of the committee tonight. Okay. If anybody has any questions about that, Senator Marty, welcome back. How are you doing?
How are you feeling? Do we get a report?
Senator Marty would like to describe
something.
Thank you.
Could you get up on that table?
They chose not to amputate.
Surgery.
Yeah. She's trying to get the copy.
Oh.
Oh, we're waiting.
She'll have copies for everyone else, right? This is two pages, right?
Three.
I'm sorry, three. We're happy to indulge you, Senator Clark.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark, it looks similar to the original bill, but I know there's some important differences, but it, essentially...
There are several differences, and I'll just broadly describe the bill when you're ready, and then I can talk about what the differences are.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, Senator Clark, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is essentially good faith legislation. It is a fundamental consumer protection that Minnesotans deserve. Basically, when we purchase insurance in our state, we're pooling our resources to basically protect ourselves in case something goes wrong. And in our state, one of the things that has happened at times, not exclusively, is that instead of us making a claim and then having it paid out, essentially getting what we paid for, there is at times unequal treatment and a kind of a take it or leave it policy because there isn't any penalty in the law to hold insurance companies accountable. 46 other states currently do this practice. We're not a leader in this. We're not even a maverick. I'd say if we join the other states, we will be a follower, kind of catching up on a basic consumer protection. Essentially, what it does is it requires the companies to treat the consumers fairly and, again, make the claim, pay out the claim, unless there's a good reason to not do so. The other component of this bill is directly being able to name the company. Right now, if I was in a car wreck and my husband was driving, I would have to sue him in order to actually get to the insurance company. I can get to the insurance company, but I have to go through my loved one. This is something that Wisconsin has had in law for over 40 years. They actually see less claims than we do. And both of these pieces we think are important as we move forward to try to make sure that people get what they pay for. The things that are different in this bill, and then I also have Will Flugel from the Trial Lawyers Association who will start off, Madam Chair, to clarify a few things if you have questions. And then we have a few people who have been directly impacted to basically give the examples. We're not trying to say that our insurance companies are bad. They are not bad. But under our current law, they do not have to go ahead and make sure the claim is paid out. The things that are changed from the original draft begin on page 2. Again, on line 2.12, as we talked about previously, we've exempted health carriers. Also on lines 2.15 and 2.16, we've clarified this to make sure that this does not apply to a political subdivision. It would not apply to the county insurance trust, for example. So those are out. On line 2.18, it makes sure when you see injured party, it makes sure that it's a private cause of action, not something else. And on lines 2.20 through 2.23, we wanted to make sure that the insurance agents weren't directly liable. So unless an agent has settling authority, this does not apply to them. And then lastly, on page 3, you'll notice that it's eliminated on lines 3.4. It's eliminating pending cases. So it only would go forward. It would not have a backward impact.
Senator Clark, I have a couple questions. Of the 46 states that have what I think they call bad faith,
it depends. Laws. Some states call them different things, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I think that the bulk, if not all, refer to it as bad faith. I think, how many of those are statutory? 9? Is that correct?
I'm not sure what the actual number is. Just a moment, Madam Chair, if we could have Mr. Flugel
answer
that question.
I believe it. Madam Chair, my name is Will Flegel, and I'm here on behalf of the Trial Lawyers Association. The last study information that I have available is from 2005. At that time, 11 states had statutory bases. It seems as if the legislature is calling it good faith, and where it's adopted through the court system, it's punishing bad faith. It accomplishes essentially the same aim. So if you look at the different states, you've got one framework that is statutory and sets a goal for exacting a minimum standard of good faith. And then the courts have, where they've created a cause of action, giving a private individual the right to make a claim, have done so in a manner of punishing what they have characterized as bad faith.
Okay. So are there any questions of Senator Clark?
No.
This is going to be on the amendment to put the bill in the shape that she would like it. So. And Senator Marty has moved that. You want to wait, Senator Gerlach? Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Gerlach, did you have a question or a comment here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm confused and I wanted to follow up. The handout that I have, Madam Chair, says 46 other states have good faith laws. Senator Clark said in her testimony 46 states have good faith laws, but then you asked the question and then apparently the answer is 11. I'm confused. The difference between 46 and 11, that was not clear to me as why there's a discrepancy.
I think it's court-created law, common law, in most of the states, Senator Gerlach. So it's law, but it's not statutory. That was the point I was
making. I see.
I was just
the
clarifying.
Distinction between them. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Okay. Mr. Flegel.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you kindly for the opportunity to present. I'll keep my remarks brief. I'm here mainly as a resource to address questions. I know there are a number of individuals who'd like to come forward and tell their personal experiences, and that may be more meaningful. The Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association supports efforts to create a legislative standard for good faith in Minnesota. By court rule, under Rule 11 of our Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, attorneys on each side of a contest that makes its way to court owe responsibilities of good faith and can be subject to sanctions for bad faith, either taking a frivolous claim forward or pursuing a frivolous defense. By state law, under Minnesota Statute 549.211, any individual litigant, a party to a lawsuit, who proceeds in bad faith or fails to exercise good faith, stands accountable to have to pay attorney's fees and expenses. The state law that we have at present does not hold or provide the same responsibility to insurers in the typical types of litigation that find their way through our court system. This legislation that's proposed would essentially exact that requirement of good faith for insurers as well. We do have the Fair Claims Practices Act, which is a regulatory guideline under Chapter 72A of our statutes, but no private cause of action is permitted to individual insureds of insurance policies who feel that they have not been dealt with in good faith by their own insurer. The good faith legislation that before you would bring Minnesota into the fold of those states, either the 11 that by statute or the 35 by case law development, totaling 46, have pursued this type of program to facilitate consumers' rights in Minnesota. The statute, the bill, I should say, also proposes a direct right of action so that insurers may be named as parties. This makes it similar to, in many respects, to the Wisconsin statute that was passed in 1965. There are 20 other states that have at least some limited basis for direct action in which an insurance company that has the control over the litigation, it would pay its insurance proceeds in the event someone accused of wrongdoing had been found responsible by a jury, would make the insurer able to be named as a party. In that way, I think we have more of an open process in which jurors can realize the involvement of all of those who are present, and we avoid the unpleasant circumstance in which where, as Senator Clark indicated, a family is riding together and you have to go through essentially the fiction of the husband suing the wife in order to make the insurance policy be activated. Direct action would bring Minnesota with that majority of states that permit, at least in some limited capacity, a direct action.
Mr. Flegel, may
yes.
I ask? Gee, don't we already know if the person has insurance if they're being sued?
Madam Chair, actually, no. The jury is deprived of that information. Under our current court rules, the judge alone is permitted to inquire about insurance without telling jurors what's involved. The judge asks essentially the same three questions without any factual context or background. Is anyone here a shareholder, employee, or insured of the XYZ insurance company? The parties then the jurors then respond, but no one may take action based upon those answers. In Wisconsin, where this is done, a jury instruction is given to the jurors that advises them that there you may see reference to an insurance company. Because the title of this case includes an insurance company as a defendant, there is no question as to insurance in the special verdict, however. This is because there's no dispute of fact regarding insurance in this case. Whether or not the defendant is liable or not liable for damages is the same whether the defendant is insured or not insured. Under your oath as jurors, you are bound to be impartial to all parties in this case, so you should answer the questions in the verdict just as you would whether there is insurance or not. That's how it's done in Wisconsin, where you have a direct action, Madam Chair.
So in Minnesota, the court rules don't allow that evidence today.
In Minnesota, by court practice, that is the case. The attorneys, as advocates, are not permitted, unless they have leave of the court to do so, to make any inquiry about insurance whatsoever. And most, well, many jurors are, some may be aware, some may not.
Okay. And there may, in fact, not be insurance. It's possible.
It's conceivable, Madam Chair. It would certainly deprive the parties of a great deal of incentive to take forward a matter if there was no chance of compensation, obviously.
Okay, please continue, although we want to keep moving here.
Madam Chair, the most reassuring aspect of the bill as it's drafted to me is the use of a standard that has a very clear definition within Minnesota law, and that is that insurers, before they could be held to be responsible under the standard as it's projected, would have to be in a circumstance where there was no objectively reasonable basis for whatever conduct they did in delaying or denying or defending against payment. That's a term of legal art that's familiar in a number of contexts. For example, in environmental law, the objectively reasonable standard is measured against what a prudent person having the same information as that which was available to the individual in question would have believed at the time that the decision was made. In tax law, a position that lacks an objectively reasonable basis is one that is entirely devoid of legal or factual support at the time that it was made. In criminal law in Minnesota, an objectively reasonable basis is a reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing based on the information available. So the courts should have no problem understanding that term. It essentially means that as opposed to a personal or subjective perspective, instead there was no reasonable basis in an objective capacity for a person, for an insurer doing what it did.
Mr. Flegel, don't most states who have law on this, well, the 46, don't most of them use the reckless disregard standard? How is that different from this? As I looked over what other states do, I didn't see objectively reasonable basis or some kind of what I'd call negligence standard. I saw a higher standard here.
Madam Chair, the reckless disregard standard is often used in those states that have adopted their good faith or bad faith proposition by means of case law rather than legislatively, and is usually tied to a punitive damages, either statute or framework that exists. There are, if memory serves, 13 states who use the reckless standard. Where more typically you'll find that the law has developed is a reasonable person standard, where would it be reasonable for the insurer to make this judgment based on the facts that it had as opposed to a mere hunch or supposition? Was there a factual basis? Whether or not there was may be a point of debate, and at that point then you have not made an unreasonable action if you had a defensible evidence for the position that you took. It's the lack of any reasonable evidence whatsoever that would give rise to a claim under these circumstances, Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon, did you have a question that you wanted to know?
Madam Chair, my questions are much more general, and I was wondering if they were going to walk through the bill.
I thought.
My question is, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pretner-Solon.
What's the intention of this?
I'm sorry.
What's the intention of the bill?
Mr. Flegel.
Madam Chair, Senator, the intent of the bill is to provide a consumer with the right to assure that the insurance company that they have paid premiums to will act with them in good faith, that the insurance company will pay claims that it should, and if it has a justifiable, reasonable basis to deny claims, that therefore it can proceed to do that. The bill proceeds, first of all, in the first section, to lay out the nature of the entities that it applies to, a policy for insurance with respect to liability. And as Senator Clark indicated, this does not apply by its definition section to units of state government. They're exempted from this, as are health insurance policies. The primary focus would be liability insurance, such as we might encounter in a motor vehicle accident, or someone has slipped and fallen on my property. My property insurance is now defending me. Is there a reason for them to deny coverage to me or to deny the claim? Then the definitions section proceeds next into the second section, indicating that a direct right of action exists so that where insurance does apply, the insurer may be named as a party in the proceeding. The third section of the bill exacts that good faith standard that we were speaking about, requires as the minimum standard of conduct that an insurer act in good faith in connection with handling claims that are made under a policy that it has sold. There are definitions of insurance policy and of insurer. The penalties section in subdivision 2 under what will be 604.18 makes it clear that this is a private cause of action for individual insureds to raise on an individual basis. And then subdivision 3 is again an exclusion that says that essentially insurance agents are not going to be subject to this standard unless they had actual authority to either deny a claim or to pay a claim, and that's obviously not the typical role of agent who merely sells the policy. Subdivision 4 requires a report to the commissioner so as to determine the utility, compliance with the bill once it becomes law, and under Section 4 of the bill, money is appropriated for that purpose. Its effective date would be for claims commenced on or after August 1, 2007.
Senator Prettner. So,
Madam Chair, Mr. Flugel, maybe a more direct question would be, what is the problem? Why is this bill necessary? What will it do differently?
Mr. Flugel.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, I can give you a very brief synopsis. I don't want to monopolize the time here. There are a number of individuals who have individual and unique stories to tell who I think will give you some concrete examples of that. Because there is no law that requires good faith, an insurer has the capacity to deny a claim or delay its payment and to hire a defense of a claim even if it lacks a good faith basis for doing so under current law. This bill would allow a remedy to the individual insured to actually enforce the terms of their policy and have that benefit. That's its fundamental purpose.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
And Senator Prettner Solon. I think, kind of going back to what I said at the beginning, this is essentially people purchase insurance believing that if something happens that they can make good on a claim. And that's not necessarily the case right now. One of the things I didn't say at the beginning is I believe this would actually lessen the attorney involvement, because right now you shouldn't need to get an attorney, which you're going to hear from several people, just to get a basic claim paid for. Instead, this would basically say, look, something happened at my house. It was covered under the insurance. You're going to get it paid for. And that's something people reasonably should be able to expect when they're purchasing insurance. The other part really is about not putting our loved ones through having to name them in lawsuits. I mean, if we're basically going to be having the insurance company involved in certain situations, why don't we just be honest and open about it instead of having to go through our kids, our spouses, our loved ones? So those are the two things.
Senator Scogin.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. I just thought I could amend my bill on.
Does this happen a lot? And the second part of that for me is, what does a consumer that feels they haven't been treated fairly do now? I mean, they have options, right?
Senator Clark or Mr. Flegel, who?
Madam Chair, Senator Scogin, this does happen, and you're going to hear some stories about what happens when it does and how frustrating it will be.
I believe it happens. Does it happen a lot?
Mr. Flegel.
Madam Chair, Senator Scogin, yes, I believe that it does. As long as most insurance companies proceed to pay bills where they have evaluated a claim in an objective manner and gone This is something for which our insured did something wrong, and we should pay on this claim or not pay on this claim. But until that there is a financial inducement for them to do so, because a penalty will exist if they don't, they have no incentive to do the right thing. This gives them the incentive to do the right thing. At present, their only option where an insurer has not done the right thing and paid a claim that they should, whether they're the defendant and the insurance was defending them, or they're the claimant and this is their homeowner's insurance and they've had hail damage or whatever, is to make a go out and hire a lawyer and make a claim under the terms of the insurance policy, which will ultimately pay for the roof, but not for the lawyer. Which will ultimately, if they have a claim that's made against them and they're accused of some wrong, the insurance company, if it's delaying the claim, is subjecting their own insured to further participation in the legal process. That can stretch matters out for the defendant as well as for the claimant under those circumstances. And the only right that exists to a person who's a defendant in a claim and forced to go through litigation is to await a trial, have a verdict in excess of your insurance proceeds be returned by a jury, and then sue the insurance company for having subjected you to do that. You have no direct right of access or control to them unless there's a law like this that makes them do the right thing.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to respond also to Senator Scogin's question. As I think probably all the committee members know, I've worked before coming to the legislature in this area, so I would expect you would take my bias perhaps into consideration in terms of my addressing this question. But I can tell you from firsthand experience, Senator Scogin, that this does happen far too often. In very many cases, when a client comes to an attorney, it's because they've first attempted to negotiate the case with the insurance adjuster, and far too often there's an expectation in a first-party claim like this that there's going to be a discount of the value of their insurance policy simply because the insurance adjuster knows that person is going to go to a lawyer like myself, and I'm going to have to tell that client that if they wish to hold the insurance company accountable for the full value of the policy, that they are going to have to go through very expensive, time-consuming litigation to actually achieve the results of that policy and to receive a fair settlement. Now, there are many cases where the insurance company has a legitimate reason to argue about the amount that should be the value of the claim or whether there's actually an issue regarding liability. And in those cases, this law would not apply. But in cases where clearly using an objective standard they should be paying the full value of the policy, this law puts the policyholder on a level playing field with the insurance company so that they can't use that their power as being able to pay the cost of litigation much more easily than an individual person and can't use that leverage to convince an insured person to accept a much lower amount than would be reasonably would be expected for the type of injury or damage that they'd sustain. So it does happen a lot, and in my experience, it's not as bad when you're dealing with a local adjuster from your own community, but when you're dealing with someone, as is often the case, who's sitting many states away, and you're talking to someone who really doesn't even have the authority to make the decision. They've been given marching orders from someone else. You really don't have any other avenue than to go through the court process, and they know that. And so that isn't a very good avenue when it's going to cost you a lot of money and cause a lot of delay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
It may be helpful to have our testifiers come up because I think that they will illustrate some of what Senator Olson just said, but at least provide a better example of what, more concrete example of what we're talking about as opposed to us talking theoretically.
Right, with the understanding that, I mean, facts do get in the way here. Facts are important. Facts are important in any case, and that is probably appropriately decided in the court, but sometimes they are in question, and I think that's when you see things going to trial. I mean, that would be, frankly, the only reason. because I think under our fair claim settlement practices, you know, I'd argue that we do have standards for insurance companies. And I think when this bill was presented in the other body, I would make a direct quote, 99% of the time insurance companies do process claims without delay and without inappropriate denial. So, and I didn't see anybody later in the testimony that stepped forward and said that was incorrect. So I think we're talking about a small number here in answer to committee members' questions. And I think that you find those problems when you do come up against facts. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I just mean that facts are what are involved here in these court cases. But Senator Clark, please proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair. Like to call up Marilyn Skopinski.
Still sick.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, and please say your name for us.
My name is Marilyn Skopinski, and I thank you for allowing me to appear before your committee.
Absolutely.
As I've mentioned, my name is Marilyn Skopinski. My husband and I live on Sargent Avenue, very near the University of St. Thomas. And during my professional career, I worked for many nonprofit organizations, including the University of Minnesota, and ultimately retiring from the University of St. Thomas, where I was the stewardship officer for the university. My husband is a tenured professor at the university and is currently a vice president there. When I was 15 years old and learning to drive, my parents had State Farm insurance. When I graduated from college at 22, I bought my own car and then purchased State Farm insurance. When I married, my husband and I continued with State Farm insurance. So for well over 40 years, I have been continuously insured by State Farm. And during that time, I have had no serious driving violations, no auto insurance claims, and no need for their help until November 16th, 1995. On that date, I left the 4th Street parking ramp at the University of Minnesota to go back to my office and crossed at 4th Street in a crossing area when a young man accelerated his vehicle and struck me, throwing me up and over the hood, causing me to break his windshield with my head and causing other serious injuries, not the least of which were a badly broken left ankle, which required surgery, plus a damaged left hip and a damaged shoulder. State Farm hired several doctors to conduct their own medical examinations, which caused several delays in payment of my no-fault benefits. They also told us flat out that we would have to sue them to get any underinsured motorist benefits. My husband and I were clear with State Farm that we only wanted my medical benefits paid. We never have sued and never wanted to sue and made that clear to State Farm. My medical bills related to this accident are over $40,000 at this point. The young man that hit me had liability coverage at $100,000 with, yes, State Farm Insurance Company. We had purchased $50,000 in under insurance coverage from State Farm, so there was $150,000 available to help me, $100,000 liability, and $50,000 underinsured. Given State Farm's resistance to pay my bills, we had to find an attorney. Then we had to sue State Farm. My lawyer actually first sued the young man that struck me, and Hennepin County Mandatory Arbitration found $240,000 worth of damages. State Farm paid the $100,000 covering the driver and substituted themselves as defendants in the Hennepin County proceeding, appealing the arbitration and forcing us to full jury trial. The jury returned a verdict of $305,280, but State Farm only had to pay their $50,000 in coverage a full 3 years after the coverage, after the accident. I trusted State Farm to insure me if any catastrophe occurred in my life. I had to find and hire an attorney to compel them to be responsible. I had to endure medical examinations, delay, expenses, inconvenience, and the embarrassment of having to go to court and to before a jury. I am not a lawyer and have not read the bill before your committee, but I understand that it would prevent the kind of expense, delay, and emotional distress that I experience. So I urge you, please pass this bill out of committee so that hopefully it will pass and prevent others from experiencing what I have had to endure. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Kapansky, thank you very much.
Senator Clark?
Yes, Madam Chair. Teresa Janicek. And Madam Chair and members, I just want to make sure that I say for the record, this is not about any specific insurance company. Everybody has different insurance companies, and certainly they all strive to do good work. That's not what the issue is. So I don't want these proceedings to start talking about whose insurance company does what.
Okay. Thank you. Is it Janicek?
Yes.
Please identify yourself then, just for the tape.
Right. Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Teresa Janicek. I currently live in Woodbury with my husband, Jeff, and have lived there for 13 years. I own a small business there, a welcoming service, where I welcome and greet new residents as they move into the community. And then I also serve on the Woodbury Chamber of Commerce Board and have been a member of the chamber for 10 years. And also serve as president of Woodbury Days Council, which is a local volunteer nonprofit in our community that plans our community celebration. And I've done that for the last 10 years and enjoyed that as well. And I'm here again to share a story that happened to myself and my husband, Jeff. We had been with the same insurance company for about 16 years and came where a storm came and hit our community, and part of our siding was ripped off of our house. And when it happened, we thought, okay, well, there's just a couple pieces of siding. We're going to try to find the siding and replace the siding so that it would be no big deal. And I proceeded to look for that siding and couldn't find it. It was actually discontinued. They didn't make it any longer. And so I wasn't able to replace the siding. And then I started noticing that our neighbors were getting their roofs and siding replaced. And after having talked to them, found out that they had hail damage and wind damage from the same storms that had come through. And so we actually had a contractor come out to look at our house because we thought all we had was these pieces of siding. And he looked at the house and determined that we had hail damage on our roof and then siding damage on the house. And so we contacted our insurance agent and told him what had happened and made a claim. And they sent out an adjuster, and he came and said that we had no damage on the roof and that we had no hail damage on the siding, but we did have wind damage because the siding was ripped off the house. So he would look into the coverage for our siding, and it was determined that they would cover our siding, and because it wasn't made, they had to replace all of our siding because they couldn't get just replacement pieces. He did deny that there was any damage on the roof, or said there was no damage on the roof. So we contacted the insurance company again and asked for another adjuster to come out because we felt there was damage to the roof according to our contractor. And then also in the meantime, 10 other houses, both houses to each side of us and across from us, all had their roofs covered and their siding covered from hail damage. So to us, it seemed unlikely that ours was the only house that didn't have damage, plus our contractor told us that it did. And so they sent out another adjuster, and he came and said, yes, there was damage to the roof, but the damage to the roof was a mold that formed on the roof and then exploded when it would get hot and leave a pit mark in the roof that would be the same as a hail pit mark on the roof. And so we said, okay. we didn't know what to say, really, but we just felt that if the other houses were all damaged from hail, you know, how could it have missed our house and still hit all their houses? And actually, the siding that was damaged on our house was more severe than the other houses, so it seemed kind of strange to us. But at that point, we had nothing we could do, and we asked them to have someone else come out. And when we did have the second adjuster come out, he actually met with our adjuster as well and told this to our adjuster. And the adjuster said that if it were mold damage that did that, that the two are so similar that it would be impossible to figure out if it was, you know, some type of a mold that exploded or hail. And since there was other hail damage to the area, it would be more likely that it was hail than it was the mold. But they denied the claim, and my husband and I, you know, in the beginning never even wanted to make a claim because we had always heard that if you make a claim, you'll lose your insurance. We finally decided to make it and ended up being denied for the roof. Our contractor felt so strongly that it was damaged and felt bad that we were denied coverage. He actually offered to replace our roof at his cost. So instead of the $8,500 that was our original estimate for the roof, he did it for $4,800 at his cost, and all I did was pay his invoices. So he made no money on it because he felt that strongly that it should have been covered, and it wasn't. And we had no recourse as far as we understood it, so that was the only thing we could do. So we did pay him to then replace our roof at his cost and just paid his invoices for the cost of the labor and the materials for our roof.
So were you given an opportunity? Did you contact the Department of Commerce, or were you given an opportunity for arbitration? I actually went through a similar situation with my roof.
Yep. We were told the only thing we could do is, I think, talk to a mediator, arbitrator, and we didn't have any intention or have any desire to sue or do anything like that. I was planning, my only intent was to write to the insurance commissioner just to let him know of the practice of what we felt was unfair to us. But no, we did not go to any other. I didn't really honestly know of any other means besides what I was told. And I knew we weren't going to sue because that would be more expensive than just replacing our roof. So we chose to just replace our roof.
Okay, Ms. Janicek, thank you very much.
Tough name. Thanks.
Senator Clark.
Yes, Janice and Tom Stantine.
Tom? And then do you have someone else right after
right,
this?
We have one more. We just wanted to That's give fine. The committee a variety of types of situations.
Please just say your names for the record. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Janice Stadheim. We live in Lake City now, but we did live in Rochester.
Okay. I'm John Stadheim, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
Pleased to meet you.
Have you decided who's going to speak here?
Well, John can go ahead.
Okay.
Our situation was happened back in 2002. When we lived in Rochester, they put in new streets and all new utilities, and we lived on a hill, and the hill was lime rock. So they came in, took pictures of our house prior to dynamiting, and then they dynamited in the street, and a shot went through our house. And the estimate to repair the house was $188,000. And the first adjuster that came, he wanted to put us up in a townhouse or whatever so that they could go in and estimate the damage and start making repairs. And he was immediately taken off of the job, and they sent down a new adjuster from the cities, and that's when everything started to go the other way.
Mr. Stanton, was this your insurance company?
Yes. Our insurance company, yes.
Boston Light.
Not the people who caused the damage?
Pardon me?
Can I
explain this? The city was developing our neighborhood with affordable housing. And they had to put sewer in, so they tore all our streets up. And so it was the dynamite company, but they did not carry full replacement. And so this is where our insurance came in, because we had that. And they would only cover a certain percentage. And they did not deny the damage, but they're willing just to pay so much. And so our insurance company came back, like John said, and came and inspected it and said it was old age and frost.
Pardon me, I missed that.
Frost, oh. And they called it frost and old age. They brought down a...
That's why they denied our claim, was because they said it was just frost and old age. Where I had even city officials go through my house and recognize it, but they were not responsible, because it was the dynamite company and our insurance. And I was standing in the garage when it happened with the supervisor. It was really an experience. It was like an earthquake. I mean, the house just... And I went out and talked to the office, the workers. They said the house rocked like this. And the rugs that I had in the garage went like this. It was just a wave. A terrible experience. And it was traumatic for us, too. We had lived there 43 years. And John likes a homestead. He came from the farm. And he doesn't like to move around. And so we just kept improving our house. And we were very proud of it. And so it was traumatic.
Well, it was frightening, but it was also sad.
Yes. Oh, I couldn't get him to move. I wanted to, but, oh, no, this is my house, and, you know, this is what he wanted.
Well,
Mr. Stanton.
Of course, we had to get an attorney.
Yeah.
And our attorney said, you know, this is just completely opposite. He said, your insurance should cover your claim, and then they should go after the dynamite company to recover the damage. But it went just the other way around.
And consequently, it did cost us over $10,000. I mean, we settled and we got a nice, not all of it, but we did get a good settlement between the two companies. But then it turned around and we had to pay $10,000 to do it.
Took 2 years.
And all the stress. Well, we went to Lake City and built a new house on the Jewel.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So,
but I understand
so
you went through a trauma.
So I got him out of the house.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And he likes it there, though.
But yeah. it was very, very frustrating.
Yeah. It was sad. It was very sad.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank
Chairman.
You.
We have one more.
Senator
person.
Clark.
Terry Sandman.
Is it Mr. Sandman?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to our committee.
Senators, my name is Terry Sandman. I reside with my wife and three young boys in northeast Edina in the country club area. And my story relates to a fire incident back in December 22nd, specifically of 99. My wife and I had recently purchased this home and moved in, and we were putting our Christmas cards together and started our fireplace at 6:30 in the morning and burned it all day and put it out at midnight before we went to bed. And at 2 a.m., we were awakened by smoke alarms going off upstairs, and we walked down into flames. And about what happened is about two-thirds of the downstairs burned, and it happened to be a night when there was 20 below zero, and so most of the smoke went upstairs. And before the fire department got there, about two-thirds of the downstairs burned, but the structure itself was retained. It was a brick house. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, the insurance company, the agent, took us to the hotel, actually right off of 494 and 100. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, I can remember this to this point, I got a call from one of the construction companies that was on a retainer from, at the time, the insurance company, and said that with our blessing, they could have a dumpster in front of the house in 2 hours and be renovating by the afternoon. And we found that to be a little bit peculiar in that, one, the house is somewhat unique. It was built by an architect back in the 30s and had some unique features. And so certainly we didn't want to destroy, you know, the home at that point. And long story short is the policy that we had was a replacement policy. The what turned out to be the total amount to repair the house did not exceed our policy coverage. Plus, we had replacement coverage. And in the policy itself, it is stated that if we choose to find an independent builder, which we did, with their approval, they would be blessed. And so that process took about 3 months. We did find an independent builder and worked right along with this insurance company and the adjuster and got all the bids and what it would cost to repair the home. And about 3 months after that, we started demolishing the house, basically gutting it to the studs on the approval of the insurance company. And once we got to that state, the house was gutted, we got a letter from the insurance company stating that they were reassessing their position and the adjuster was being removed from the case and that any correspondence that we should have at this point coin should be to that person's supervisor, and they also gave word of their attorney. And at that point, in trying to contact the agent wouldn't return our calls, and so we were forced to get legal counsel ourselves, which we did. We had a $90,000 discrepancy between what was originally agreed on to repair the house versus what they said they would fix. And examples of where the discrepancy came is that in the fire itself transferred into the wall of the house, and with the replacement policy, as was defined by this company, is that they, in the second wave through their bid, said that their definition of replacement is to repair a $3,500 hole in the wall, yet the Edina fire inspector would not allow us to burn another fire in this house unless the whole structure was brought down and put back up, to the tune of about $12,000 to $13,000. So it was little examples like that where there was discrepancies in the process. So we ended up getting our legal counsel and went to arbitration in the process. We were awarded $50,000 of the $90,000, but we spent $40,000 out of our pocket to fight this process. Plus, it took about 15 months. And in the process, we stayed with my wife's sister and family, and which conceptually was okay, but I might suggest it was a longer family reunion that we typically would
yes.
like. But the whole process was a little painful, and as you might expect, and a process that at least my wife and I do not believe that homeowners and those who are insured ought to go through.
Mr. Sandman, your family is safe, though.
Yes, it was before
okay,
we had kids, so it was my wife and I. So, yes, we did get out okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Senator Clark, anybody else?
No, Madam Chair.
Then, I have some people that wish to testify. I'd like to, I think we have about 20 minutes. We're not going to quite make my goal, but I wanted people to have an opportunity. When people take time out of their day and even travel some distance to get here to testify, I want them to be able to have their say. So I'm glad that everybody was able to speak, Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I have Mr. Is it Thornsio and Abrams.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Am I saying, well, I know I'm not saying your name right, so I'm going to let you introduce yourselves.
You are absolutely.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Dale Thornsio,
okay.
And it is the way you pronounced
okay.
it. I'm an attorney in private practice in the Minneapolis area. I am also a co-chair of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association Insurance Law Committee. I've represented in my 22 years of practice both policyholders and insurance companies, and I appear today in opposition of both of the substantive aspects of the bill, Senate File 1152. The first provision that I'll talk about is the bad faith provision. This is a broadly worded provision which does not address the specific perceived ills of the insurance industry, and we even heard that today. The people that talked today provided their side of the story involving first-party benefit matters and not third-party benefit matters. This bill does not address the specific aspects of what has been brought to the committee's attention today.
Mr. Thornsio, since we're not the Judiciary Committee, would you just clarify for the committee first-party and third-party? I mean, I don't want to insult my colleagues, but I think it would be helpful to.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that. First party is when the policyholder actually has a claim against their own insurance company. And each of the people that testified today were talking about claims against their own insurance company. A third party benefit claim is where in a car accident and somebody goes through a stop sign and strikes another individual, they would bring a lawsuit against the tortfeasor, against the at-fault driver, and that party would have insurance. And that is considered a third-party situation where the plaintiff would have a claim against the policyholder of the liability policy.
Thank you.
The standards that are presented in this bill really fail to take into consideration the bad faith law as established in Minnesota to date. The objectively reasonable standard that is referenced by Mr. Flugel is not consistent across all areas of the law, and so we really don't know what that standard means. What we do know, though, is that the Supreme Court has recognized an insurer's good faith obligation to an insured for 50 years in this state, starting with the case in 1957. Bad faith is actually already established in this state, and a viable claim is available in Minnesota. Its standards are consistently being considered and applied as necessary by the judiciary. In fact, before the Court of Appeals right now is a major bad faith case, which will address and define further the extent of the bad faith law in Minnesota. There will continue to be such cases that will be brought before the courts, and that will allow the judiciary an availability to evolve the law in light of the very specific issues which are faced and to fashion specific remedies as specific cases warrant. And in light of this consistent judicial regulation, legislative regulation, especially one such as this bill, which does not provide specific standards or specific remedies, really does not provide the consuming public with an appropriate response. This bill doesn't take into consideration the experience that other states have had with their more developed bad faith law, and I will be deferring to Mr. Jerome Abrams to my far left here to talk about that further. The bill will be costly to taxpayers. As conveyed to this committee on Thursday, February 8th of this year, premiums to Minnesota policyholders are based on the claims made and paid in Minnesota. Ambiguity, such as found in this provision, necessarily increases the costs paid on those claims, the resulting higher claim payments and transaction costs that will be involved to buy off these vague bad faith claims will result in higher premiums to your constituents and higher court costs to address the expected flood of bad faith claims which will be asserted. Carriers' claims handling activities are already heavily regulated through the Department of Commerce. And there were questions, Madam Chair, addressing whether submissions had been made to the Department of Commerce. And I think what you end up finding is consistently throughout these processes is that parties are not taking advantage of the regulatory opportunities that are available in submitting matters to the Department of Commerce. I will note to the committee, excuse me.
I know it's easy to mistake.
I
have a gavel.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
I can only dream.
What you see in a packet that has been handed out by the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association today is a copy of a petition for further review that was filed in the Minnesota Supreme Court in a bad faith case involving silicone breast implant litigation. That case really underscores what Mr. Abrams will talk about in the bad faith context, and that is the cottage industry that ends up being developed when a party believes it has an opportunity to collect damages as opposed to seeking redresses for bad faith claim handling. Now, the policyholder in the silicone breast implant case, yes, was denied recovery by the Minnesota Supreme Court. However, they clearly didn't believe their bad faith claim was viable because they'd never made a submission to the Department of Commerce to find regulatory responses or regulatory investigation of those claim handling activities. And I submit to the committee that if there truly was an intent to talk about bad faith claims handling, the Department of Commerce would have been involved long ago. However, instead, what we end up seeing is a cottage industry to recover attorney's fees if such a provision as this is passed. Let me talk briefly about the direct action aspects of this bill as well. 48 states have not enacted this provision. There's only Louisiana, which is really a different area, and then there's Wisconsin. The overwhelming understanding as to why other states have not adopted this provision is an understanding that informing the jury of the presence of insurance biases jury to award an enhanced level of damages which are not supported by the compensatory nature of the claim. Direct actions, in fact, provide the mistaken assumption that the mere presence of insurance means the entire damage award. Not just the amount insured, but the entire damage award is actually covered by the insurance. In other words, if we have a situation where a tortious husband injures his wife in a car accident, such as what Senator Clark has talked about, what we end up having is the jury will have a mistaken belief that the entire damage award is covered by insurance, irregardless of the policy limits. What we then end up having is an excess judgment that realistically can be asserted against the husband because of the wife's claim. The husband is then personally liable for those amounts, and we set up the absolutely incredible situation of potentially having a guardian for the wife attempting to garnish wages from the husband to pay for the care and necessity for the wife. And if we talk about problems with one family member suing another, just think of the problems that we'll have when excess verdicts that are imposed upon each and every one of your constituents happens because somebody has a jury has a mistaken presumption that there is enough insurance to cover the entire verdict when many times there will not be. The insurance company is not the entity which created the liability. I urge the committee to keep the jurors' eyes on the ball, to assess the merits of negligence claims solely on the conduct of the defendant and not on the presence of a perceived bottomless pit.
Mr. Tharnshaw, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Abrams.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for giving me this opportunity. I'm an attorney. My office is in Minneapolis. I have and do represent both insurers and policyholders in bad faith litigation.
And could you give us your name, please?
Yes, Jerome Abrams.
Thank you.
And I personally conducted trials involving these cases in a number of jurisdictions. As part of my background, I lecture to attorneys on bad faith and continuing legal education classes, and I, from time to time, am asked to address groups nationally, groups of insurers and groups of claims handlers in connection with bad faith claims and claims handling practices. And recently, I've had some experience out in California, and I want to explain to the committee just a little bit about how that might impact the situation that you're considering here. If you want to briefly consider their experience, back in 1979, through a Supreme Court case in California, they interpreted their state's bad faith law to apply to claims asserted by people who are injured in accidents. In other words, a person who was hurt, who would be suing an insured, also had a right to bring a bad faith claim against the driver's insurance company. As a consequence of that, and the case that did that was called Royal Globe, as a consequence of that in 1979, there was an absolute proliferation of litigation and civil filings in the courts. The statistic I'm going to give you comes from a study that was done in 2003 exploring the work of California trial courts, a 20-year retrospective done by the California Court Administrators. And what they attribute specifically to this particular feature of California law, that is, an injured person being able to sue the defendant's insurance company, that there was a 39% increase in civil filings. Now, this is not in any way something that's a number that's contrived. This is a number that's specifically referenced in this report by the state of California associated with that particular conduct. The real problem comes or came as a consequence of deciding to who or whom is the duty of good faith owed. As proposed in this legislation, Section 3, Subdivision 1B, doesn't even limit this to the person who bought the insurance. Even in California, they had a case that said that this duty was only owed to the policyholder, not strangers to the contract. Now, this case, after running for 10 years, and this precedent allowing these suits to be brought for 10 years, was fixed or corrected by a reversal by pretty much the same court that granted this. It's in the Moradi-Sheldahl case in 1998. And what they discovered was there was a plunge in civil filings. Now, there remains in California a number of lawyers and plaintiffs who eagerly engage in tactics to ostensibly set up bad faith claims, and this remains a constant drain on court resources and a constant increase in insurer exposure. You just have to go to Westlaw and look at reported cases under insurance bad faith in California. You'll see that there's a more than a dozen Court of Appeals decisions so far this year. At rock bottom, whatever gets paid out by insurers somehow, some way, gets reflected in premiums that everyone must pay. The bill should be examined perhaps more closely to identify what it is the Senate wants to accomplish. At present, it's overbroad with probably unintended consequences and certainly with unanticipated costs. Now, if you think that the California experience won't be repeated here, that thinking is only wishful thinking. Lawyers must use all possible causes of action and remedies for their clients to protect themselves against claims of inept handling or even malpractice. If, in fact, this bill gets further consideration, at a minimum, The fiscal impact of this legislation on the courts itself needs to be considered because we anticipate it will be sizable. Finally, the bill seems to overlook that there is a system in place for dealing with claims handling issues at the administrative level, and it appears to be functioning when it's used. There is a means to deal with unhappy policyholders in courts. That right or that remedy through a breach of contract claim has always existed. It would seem that if the concern is genuine to deal with claims handling, that a survey of how it is done now, current remedies that are available, should be looked at carefully before embarking on a drastic change such as proposed by the current legislation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Abrams. Any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you. I'd first like to address a couple of questions to Mr. Thornsjoe. I was really confused when you said that there's a first-party bad faith remedy in Minnesota right now, because I've been attending continuing legal education courses in this state for 20 years, and I know that that's not what lawyers are told in continuing legal education classes. Unfortunately, I don't have Mr. Flegel's memory for citing case names, and I know that he's renowned among all of us for that ability, but I know that there have been many cases and many different avenues that attorneys have sought in this state through the court system trying to redress what's perceived as a wrong when there's no way to recoup the expenses in clearly in bad faith situations for the unnecessary time, attorney's fees and damages that are caused when claims are denied in bad faith. And it seems to me that there are cases out there that the courts have stated that this is for the legislature to address in this state. And that's what we're trying to do with this legislation. So if there are specific cases that say that we have a first-party right of addressing bad faith against the insurer, then I'd certainly like to see a list of those case citations, because I'm not aware of them. So that's one question I have for you. The second thing I'd like to say is that both of you talked about having a right to redress these issues through the Department of Commerce. And just so that the other members who may not be as actively engaged in this process as I've been are aware, it's my understanding that the Department of Commerce can attempt to mitigate or arbitrate a claim where there's been when a person is trying to resolve a claim with the insurance company, but that they actually don't have the right to enforce anything on the insurance company that the insurance company refuses to go along with. And so really that's been up to this point an empty remedy for the person who's covered by the insurance company. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Thornsjoe.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for the opportunity to address those questions. So let me address, first of all, the first-party bad faith question that you have asked. My comments were that the courts in Minnesota have recognized the concept of good faith for insurance carriers for 50 years at least. The first-party bad faith application of that, however, is not specifically recognized. And so I do not want to mislead this committee at all in saying that there is a first-party judicial bad faith remedy. However, at the same time, my comments about redress involving first-party claim handling activities, which is what this bill in part goes to, can be adequately addressed through submissions into the Department of Commerce. And let me be exactly clear and segue into the second question, Senator Olson, that you raise on this. The Department of Commerce is not the state's attorney to enforce the insurance contract itself. However, the Department of Commerce is there to make sure that the Fair Claims Handling Act is appropriately enacted and implemented. And therefore, the Department of Commerce has the ability presently, through fines and other penalties which go to the state coffers and therefore reduce the tax burden on your constituents, the ability to confirm with the insurance carrier that they have done what they are supposed to do under the Fair Claims Handling Act. Now, if in fact it turns out that the procedure that was involved meets the Fair Claims Handling Act, then at that point, It is, in essence, a good faith difference of opinion between the insurance carrier and the insured on your first-party claim situation.
Senator Olson, be mindful that this is the Commerce Committee and not Judiciary, not okay. to you, but to all of us, please.
Thank you.
Because we're concerned about insurance and the impact of insurance costs on insureds and people who feel they've been wronged, and also all of the rest of the people in the room and in our districts who pay insurance premiums, and we have to be concerned about that. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that because I think we all share that concern, as well as making sure, I guess, that the members who are hearing this testimony really fully understand the way the system works today. And I'm raising the issues related to the Commerce Department because actually that was raised by these two witnesses. And so,
Senator Olson, I'm going to ask the Commerce Department to comment on this when we're done. Okay.
But in essence, then, Mr. Thorns-Joe, I think what you are acknowledging is that in terms of an actual remedy that would benefit the consumer, the Commerce Department really doesn't have an ability to enforce a remedy for the consumer under existing law, correct?
Mr. Thorns-Joe, but at the same time, I am going to ask the Department of Commerce to comment, but Mr. Thorns-Joe.
Madam Chair, I would appreciate that the Commerce Department do weigh in on this. What you are asking is a substantive question. What I was discussing was a procedural issue. And what the bad faith law does is attempt to impose bad faith upon the claims handling aspects of a particular insurance carrier. And what I'm saying is that those abilities to enforce the Fair Claims Handling Act are already present under existing Minnesota law.
Chapter 72A.
Well, and Madam Chair, I guess I think the point I was just trying to make is really I would have to strongly disagree that if there's no way for the person who's been victimized by insurance bad faith to be compensated for the damages that they've suffered, then really we don't have anything under existing law that protects them. We only have a system that allows the state to recoup fines for itself, but we can't make them whole. And even if they were to, say, pursue a breach of contract remedy, as was mentioned by another witness, in a case of clear bad faith, they can't even recover their attorney's fees in that situation. So they don't have a way to be made whole when the insurance company's acting in bad faith in the absence of this legislation.
Now, it would seem that recovering attorney's fees has a lot to do with this legislation, I think. I mean, that's the unique difference, I think, between what we have today and what the bill proposes. Am I right?
Well, and Madam Chair, you know, sometimes there's an implication that somehow recovering attorney's fees is something that's a bad thing to do because it might benefit attorneys. But the point is that if a person is held up because it's going to cost them either more for an attorney to bring the claim, or there's going to be a loss of attorney's fees that's going to significantly cut into their losses, that's the reason to try to give them some incentive not to have to take the case to court and to reduce litigation and reduce court costs, because there actually will be a penalty if the insurance company acts in bad faith.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson,
yes,
that's not the sole remedy as well that's being sought under this. There is the potential exposure of punitive damages, of compensatory damages, of all these other types of damages that really don't have any safeguards or protections that are involved with the provision, and therefore it's vague on its face.
Okay. We are going to keep moving. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and
yes.
committee members.
Welcome.
Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. It seems very appropriate that we're in this room, and this is the Senate Commerce Committee, and at this table, this bill has been in this room. This is the fourth time in 28 years, and I've been at all four of them. What I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is start up front and urge the committee to vote no on Senate File 1152, either as introduced or the delete anything is basically the same bill with a couple of variations that I'll comment on. But Madam Chair and committee members, there's really a few key reasons, and I'll try not to be repetitive with what's been presented. This bill represents excessive and unwarranted remedy for individuals who are seeking benefits under insurance policies, be they auto, homeowners, liability policies. Excessive, unwarranted, and not in sync with what's found around the country. And I think this committee has heard, and it is quite clear, on the first two sections of the bill, the so-called direct action. Two states of America have direct action. They've been cited, Wisconsin and Louisiana. And so this is not a remedy. In fact, as the two gentlemen just left here, and this isn't the place or the committee, but the literature is filled up with courts that regularly reject this kind of approach under consumer seeking benefits under insurance policies. So direct action is not the norm. It's an exception, and for the reasons articulated in terms of the prejudicing, the process, the decision, the jury verdicts. The next bill, that's the one part. The other second part of the bill is the so-called good faith insurance practices. The point of the matter is that all of the literature, all the law review articles, all of the analysis will always refer to these as bad faith causes of action. That's just what it is, and so whatever it's called here, it is bad faith, as everyone has referenced. But, Madam Chair and committee members, the key thing is this. Again, is this in sync? Is this the norm? Is this what we find around the country? No, it is not. Do most states have some form of what's been described a first-party bad faith remedy? And the answer is yes. Most by common law, the courts have found, created, shaped the remedy in their states. And, Madam Chair and committee members, the fact of the matter, and there's, again, the literature is, again, not here, but can readily be presented, made available for the committee members to know that the standard that's found around the country, frankly, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, this Anderson case that establishes a two-part test that many states follow, many states, in fact, most states follow the Wisconsin-Anderson standard. It's a two-part, but it is an intentional standard, Madam Chair, you referred to. Conduct by the insurer that constitutes reckless disregard. Illinois has the phrase vexatious delay or denial. Conscious, deliberate. It is not a negligence standard. The provisions of Senate File 1152 clearly, and as the proponents have described, this is a negligence standard that is not the norm. It is not what's found. The packaging, then, Madam Chair and committee members, of this bill is unique, and it poses the risks that, as the previous gentlemen have just flagged. And, Madam Chair, I know we can't do it here, but I did have, and I would urge the committee at some point, there's a handout here that I put together. And this isn't the place where I can raise questions about the individuals who have come here. This committee, under a subcommittee chaired by Senator John Hottinger a decade ago, at that table and at this table, spent over 6 hours of insurance subcommittee hearings looking at 8 fire insurance claims. The individuals came in. The Commerce Department had opened files on all 8. The state fire marshal had investigated all 8 claims. And the evidence was presented here, the individuals, and it was difficult to sort through. But here's what I'd like the committee to know, and it's in here. Two of the individuals sitting at this table contending that they were unfairly treated, bowling alleys, one in Staples, Minnesota, one in Maurer County. They had been denied total fire loss claims. And it's in here. One of the gentlemen was criminally convicted of arson in the second degree and defrauding the insurer, and he went to jail later that year. The other gentleman at this table, contending he had been unfairly denied a total fire loss claim, was found by a Hennepin County jury in the trial he was pursuing. He himself deliberately set the fire. The point of the matter is this, Madam Chair and committee members, claims get denied because there's reasons to deny them. And frankly, what we have here, and then there's literature in here, Madam Chair, we have a law that gives consumers remedy. It governs the claims practices of insurers. Interestingly, it is Chapter 72A.201. It was passed in 1984, and it was written by then-Commerce Commissioner Mike Hatch. Mike Hatch wrote it. He came to this table. It was passed to protect consumers, to make certain they get the benefits under their contracts. It's enforceable by a penalty of up to $10,000 for individual violations, and it has consistently been enforced by commissioners of all 3 political parties that I've seen, with significant dollar penalties to pay disputed amounts under contracts. It's not litigation, therefore it's quicker, it is cheaper, it delivers a remedy faster than going in civil court litigating it with all those costs. So, Madam Chair, there's a remedy in place that the law has worked. It's been tuned through the years. And frankly, I think the evidence of the other states I also included in here, the West Virginia legislature ordered their commissioner of commerce or insurance a year ago to study what was going on in that state with a similar bad faith regime as these gentlemen described under the Royal Globe in California. We don't have to ask what might happen if we pass a bill like Senate File 1152. We can look at what happened in California. The court created it. The court got rid of it. We can look at what the West Virginia Insurance Commissioner studied. They got rid of it. In both instances, West Virginia, the rate filings after they got rid of the bad faith was about a 10% decrease. This was real money costing consumers to have this intense litigated enforcement on top of them. And the California courts themselves, and I'll end with the paragraph out of the California Supreme Court in this Moratti case. And again, it's worth reading, but here's the California Supreme Court looking at 10 years of experience in that state under direct action and the bad faith, a wide open regime. Here's what the court said, and this is the same court that created it 10 years earlier. These articles emphasize both the erroneous nature of our holding and the undesirable social and economic effects of the decision, i.e., multiple litigation, unwarranted bad faith claims, coercive settlements, excessive jury awards, and escalating insurance, legal, and other transaction costs. It didn't work. It cost consumers real money and premiums, and it was too high a price to pay. And there was a better alternative, which is the Administrative Claim Settlement Practices Act, enforced with significant penalties, which we have as high as any state in the nation, and it's been consistently used. So, Madam Chair, I would urge the committee to reject this bill. It is not going to advance these causes, and I think the evidence here is plain that if we are going to put cases at the table without thoroughly examining what happened, I'm trying to figure out why a developer or builder or city would use dynamite to clear a street where there's residential homes around. But I'm glad I live in Champlin. They don't use dynamite when they do development in the neighborhoods around me. But if cities are doing that and cities are buying insurance through city trusts, I heard the proponents up front saying that city trusts aren't covered by this law. So they wouldn't be able to have that. And, Madam Chair, I have to say that I think with the amendment, while I believe that it was put on to narrow the scope of the bill, health insurance is taken out of the bill. It probably acknowledges this is going to increase health care premiums. That's probably why that exception was put in the bill at the start of it. Long-term care insurance was not taken out of the bill. So long-term care insurance is kept in the bill. We're going to have then this bad faith regime hitting long-term care, hitting Medicare supplement policies, but we're going to not do it on health care. Madam Chair, I have a problem with that inconsistency, but that doesn't remedy. This bill shouldn't be passed. We don't need it. It's going to negatively affect consumers. And I would urge a no vote. Thank you.
Johnson, thank you. Senator Vandeveer, did you have a question for Mr. Johnson?
I think I'll pass, Madam Chair, okay. So we can.
Okay. And then I'm showing Mr. Marsh, Mr. Is it Helly, and Mr. Knutson. Do you all three want to come up?
Madam
Welcome.
Chair,
welcome.
Can get a page for a handout too, please.
And I really want to
we'll be
get Senator Pappas
brief.
An opportunity to get her bill heard. She has a witness here.
We'll
that
be
can't come
quite
back.
Brief. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that handout is we have. That handout is for committee members from our legal counsel in regards to this particular bill. We're going to start out.
Okay, and you're going to identify yourself and all that.
I'm Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutuals, live in Sauk Rapids. And I have two gentlemen with me today. Steve Knutson, who's president of Ram Mutual, on my left, who reinsures. They're in ESCO. They reinsure about two-thirds of our 95 mutuals across the state. And Pete Helly, who's the chairman of the board, who manages one of our member companies down in Cottonwood. We're going to start with Mr. Knutson, then Mr. Helly and myself, and we'll be brief.
Madam Chairman and committee members.
Mr. Knutson.
My name is Steve Knutson. I'm president of Ram Mutual Insurance Company, located in ESCO, Minnesota, very near Duluth. We write insurance and reinsurance, and again, I'll underline this, only in Minnesota. That's our domicile. We provide good jobs for approximately 60 fellow Minnesotans. We reinsure 59 small mutual insurance companies throughout the state of Minnesota and serve approximately 39,000 policies on a direct basis. Most of those are rural in nature. We take customer service and claims handling very, very seriously. We write in only one state. We can ill afford to have bad customer service or bad claims handling. That's what sells and retains our business for our company. We need to do a good job, and we really feel we do a good job of taking care of claims. I won't go into the direct action in good faith. I think you've heard the issues there. Certainly they're part of my position paper as well. We do feel that we have multiple means of claims resolution in place. Senator Scogin, you referred to that, and I believe that's true. In our case, you can contact our company. We're right here in the state. You can get a hold of us. Our member companies are located in your areas where many of you have constituents. They're available. You can contact your agent. You can use the appraisal process, which is in every policy that I'm aware of. Obviously, the Commerce Department is available, and I'll let the Commerce Department explain their role. We've also used the small claims option in some cases for the smaller types of claims. The bottom line is, with claims resolution for the small mutuals in Minnesota, we strive to do what is right. Also, Minnesota has a statute. It's been referred to, Chapter 72A, Point 20, that talks about fair or unfair claims practices. We follow that very, very closely. Ultimately, how would this impact our constituents and, more importantly, your constituents? If this bill is passed, we feel very strongly that those costs would be incurred by our companies and at some point in time would be returned in the form of increased premiums to your constituents. I believe a large percentage of Minnesotans would be hurt by this legislation. The winners, of course, would be the trial lawyers and a small number of claimants that may get, in my opinion, awarded inflated and, in some cases, unwarranted settlements. We wouldn't want to worry and have to put our company in risk of being convicted or found guilty of bad faith. We do take pride in investigating very thoroughly the losses that are incurred by our company. We think that's only fair to our entire policyholder and membership. The Minnesota Association of Arson Investigators is also opposed to this bill. We have a couple members of our organization that are members of that. They've talked about it. They feel very strongly that this would cause and perhaps increase the number of arsons within the state. With increased arson, they're putting their people, their investigators, at risk of loss of life and perhaps other bodily injury. The proposed bill, Senate File 1152, which is being supported by the trial lawyers, would result, in my opinion, in very poor public policy. Please vote against that bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knutson. Welcome to the committee.
My name's Pete Helly. I'm the manager of Norwegian Mutual in Cottonwood, Minnesota. I'm the chairman of the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies, also known as MAFMIC. As Marcus said, one of 95 companies, or we're representing MAFMIC 95 companies. We're the primary farm writers in the state, and we also write homeowners across the state of Minnesota. By the name, you can probably gather we're a fairly old company. 1879 is when we were formed out there in southwestern Minnesota. This current legislation really presents problems to all our companies and actually to all the customers we insure. This legislation encourages lawsuits and recoveries against our companies. This, in turn, will lead to higher rates. Not only that, this legislation could embolden arsonists, much like Steve referenced, who could see insurance companies willing to settle claims rather than fight them in court. This not only leads to increased premiums, but endangers our local firefighters as well. All of our companies are local companies. In fact, many of us write 150 townships, up to 300 townships, so we're very local. It's important for us to settle claims fairly, as our reputations are on the line with every claim. The current Unfair Claims Practices Act already accomplishes much of what this bill sets out, with the exception of allowing claimants to recover damages from our companies not covered by the policy and for attorneys to recover attorney's fees from insurance companies. All in all, our companies are neighbors. We are companies that live in our communities. We spend locally, we employ locally, and our money is invested locally. Extra expenses and claims could easily lead to double-digit premium increases for our customers. One arson claim would be at least that much, and potentially much more for many of our companies. Reinsurance rates would also rise to account for these increased risks. No one wants higher premiums, and that is what this legislation would lead to. All in all, this presents problems for our companies, most importantly, our customers and our firefighters. Please vote against passage of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Kelly, thank you.
And Madam Ms. Chair, Marsh. I'll try not to repeat.
Real quickly,
And I'll be real quick. But a couple things I do want to touch on, and I do want to reiterate again. I think there's been kind of an oranges and apples comparison with 46 states, as I understand it, and none of the three of us are lawyers. That's why we let the lawyers go first. As I understand it, the 46 states are all some version of a first party. And as in the handout from us, from our legal counsel, Wisconsin and Louisiana are the only two states that have the direct action. So, and testimony has been previous from the Defense Lawyers Association that if this first third party bad faith or good faith bill with the direct action were passed as it is written, we'd have the most open-ended litigation in the nation. There was comments made in regards to 72A.20, the Unfair Claims Practices Act. Let me tell you, from where we sit, I've been with our association for 11 years on a full-time basis. When the Department of Commerce calls, and a lot of times member companies let us know, it's not something that's taken lightly. They deal with us, I don't want to say harshly, but very, very firmly. And it hasn't mattered who the governor is. It hasn't mattered who the Commerce Commissioner is. In fact, if you think about this Unfair Claims Practices Act, Mike Hatch was Commerce Commissioner when this was passed. And I know from being in the legislature and working with former Commerce Commissioner and former Attorney General Mike Hatch, he was not soft on consumer protection. So this is a tough law. It's enforced by the department, but I do have to say that the department looks at it fairly, and if something is not covered, it's not covered, and they've been fair, and sometimes we pay and sometimes we don't. But the bottom line is that this is a very costly proposal. We don't think it's necessary. In fact, we know it's not necessary. And this is going to result in substantial premium increases. I think some of the information from California ranges 11% to 19% without a bill or with their litigation, what it was. And so we're just very concerned and appreciate the committee's indulgence and ask a no vote on this bill. Thank you.
Mark, thank you. I'd like to ask Deputy Commissioner Pat Nelson just if he could comment from the department's perspective on this and how you see. Well, I'll wait to. Mr. Nelson, welcome. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Patrick Nelson. I'm a Deputy Commissioner at the Commerce Department. I feel like a little bit between a heavyweight bout and I'm caught in the middle here. Both.
I'm sorry, Mr. Nelson.
Both sides are very articulate as to the reasons pro and con for this legislation. We have reviewed the bill, and I guess our perspective is a little more of a macro insurance marketplace perspective. And we had essentially three concerns with the bill after looking it over. Some of which the testimony you heard, you've heard that insurance premiums are going to go up in Minnesota. Our testimony on that is I ran that concept by our property casualty actuary. She reviewed the literature and some of the studies mentioned in the testimony you've already heard, and it's true. Premiums will go up. There's been a couple states that have had this kind of direct action, backed away from it partially because of the price of insurance and also the availability. That's the next thing I want to talk about. I spoke to the commissioner in West Virginia, Jane Klein. I think one of your other testifiers cited a study that they did in 05. and I wanted to ask her what was sort of the result of that effort. And they changed the law in Virginia and took away direct action, gave them something different, an administrative remedy for private individuals. But, for example, State Farm had quit writing in Virginia under their legal landscape they had prior to their legislative change. And she told me that they're now back writing and their marketplace is a little more stable. I mean, they have other issues than us. And it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, but I did want to mention that when you have a legal landscape that's different from the norm, that if this kind of structure is passed, if you're an insurance company and you have extra capital to deploy, would you stick it here or some other state? Because we do compete for insurance capital with the rest of the United States. And we do currently have a very vigorous, competitive auto and homeowners marketplace in Minnesota. And, of course, from a macroeconomic perspective, that means, it holds prices down and in fact, service is something they compete on, which would include claims paying. The last thing I wanted to mention, because I think Senator Olson brought it up, was Commerce's role in the process of making sure companies pay their claims. As many of the testifiers have already commented, the Commerce Department is the repository for action against companies who are not dealing fairly with their customers. We have 72A20, 72A.201, and we do enforce the standards, and 201 has very detailed standards about how you have to handle a claims scenario. And for example, we on the insurance area alone, we answered about 21,000 phone calls last year. We opened 3,000 files. The CRT team, which is just a specialist team in insurance that tries to resolve things without opening files, answering consumer complaint or questions, trying to do some of the mediation that the senator referred to. That unit alone had 1.3 million of recoveries for consumers, and we only count the value added. So if a company is offered X on a claim and the consumer thinks it's worth X plus 10 and we get involved and they get X plus 8, we'll just count the 8. So that's just the value added that particular division. And then lastly, we took $3,900,000 worth of civil penalties for that's all the insurance. That's not, I'm not saying that that's just related to violations of the Claims Paying Act. So we do not have the ability, as somebody pointed out, to say order a company to pay somebody's claim. But just listening to the discussion, my concept is, and the way I watch our people manage their files, the further out on the yield curve of being in the wrong in terms of bad faith, the more likely it is that we can use our administrative remedies to force them to give some of those recoveries. I think total in insurance, we had over $9 million worth of recoveries in 06. So we do have some success getting consumers the difference between what they ask for and what the company willing to sell for. And that's all I had. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, thank you. I really didn't mean to put you in a difficult position.
That's all right.
I really appreciate, because you deal with this day in and day out. Senator Clark, do you have anything?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could just say a few things.
Absolutely.
Kind of in response. First off, I think there was a question about who would the winners be under this. To me, clearly, the winners are the consumers. It's not about anybody else. The reason why we have these kinds of laws is to protect consumers, to make sure that consumers can get the product that they have paid for. With all due respect, I think a lot of this has to do with status quo versus non-status quo. Anytime there's a change, there's going to be a suggestion that there's going to be increased costs. There was a lot of different things thrown around here today. You don't have the time to go through, sift through all of that. It's not unclear. This is actually, I think, very clear and direct. This is about, here's what I've paid for in my insurance. Here's what I can get out of it. and asking people to be on their best behavior, looking at it's not a bad faith bill because we're looking for good faith. We want to go ahead and make sure that perhaps a tool, instead of putting it on the consumer, where they have to try to figure out how do they actually get the product that they've paid for, that perhaps the insurance company would start off by thinking, maybe I need to be thinking about what is out here on this claim first versus going the other way. I think that our current law needs to be updated. My understanding is that the process that's been talked about as it relates to commerce, in addition to there not being the ability to settle, that there is they're not able to determine issues of fact. These fines are only on a repetitive basis. And I'd suggest that $10,000 really isn't much anymore. There was a court case in 1986 by the name a Supreme Court case in Minnesota named by the name of Morris, where they very specifically said that if there's going to be a first party cause of action, it needs to come from the legislature. They would not do it. So there will not be that unless our body actually puts that forward. You know, I think the other piece that maybe there's several other things I was saying, but I know that you've got other things to be going on to. We did request a fiscal note, and I only got it today. The Minnesota Supreme Court said they didn't anticipate any fiscal impact. Commerce didn't anticipate any fiscal impact, nor did public safety. So I think that's the other thing that needs to be out here. Again, sometimes when there's going to be a change, people get nervous about it. But, again, the direct cost has worked fine in Wisconsin for 40 years. They've actually seen lower costs than we have. And if you do start putting the apples to apples on the good faith piece, I think you'd also find we'd see less attorney action. So I can tell you, as an attorney, I think we'd see less attorney action. If people can actually get their product, they're much more less likely to be going to court to seek redress. So I would hope that you would actually pass this on. It's got to go to judiciary next. As you said, Senator Scheid, there's many questions here that revolve around the court issues, and they can certainly be addressed there. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Clark. Senator Marty has a motion. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1152, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there any conversation or discussion, members?
1152.
Is it?
Yeah. That's 1152.
Yeah. 1152. And it would be referred to judiciary or to pass. No discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Division?
Those in favor? Aye. Okay. The motion does not prevail. Bye-bye. Members? Aye. Thank you, Senator Clark. Senator Pappas, right. At least we're going to let the person testify that you brought. You know, and I think members will go to Senate File 1533.
Thank you for accommodating our witnesses' schedule. And actually, the bill is non-controversial, so I think we should be able to get through it very quickly. In 2004, the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General proposed a law to curb the practice of equity stripping, otherwise known as foreclosure rescue schemes. The 2004 law is a model which has been replicated in other states, and it drove the worst offenders out of business, allowed legitimate transactions to go forward, and gave homeowners the tools to combat those remaining unscrupulous industry actors. But the scanners found a loophole. And what this bill does is close that loophole and make other needed changes to the 2004 law. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Just quickly tell you what this bill does. Does four principal things. It makes applicable under the statute any property in which these foreclosure purchasers have an interest, not just the foreclosed properties. The problem that has arisen is this bill or the statute only applies when it's the actual house that the resident is deeding over to the foreclosure purchaser, who in turn deeds it back.
Mr. Elwood, forgive me. I wasn't finding my bill. Did members have
is
the
it
bill?
1533.
Do you have it?
I do.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I apologize.
members and Madam Chair again. The way these things work is these folks get to a foreclosed homeowner at the very end of the deal, say, we're going to save your home. The deal is you deed your property to me. I will sell it back to you or lease it back or get it back to you in a contract for deed kind of arrangement. So it put the homeowner back in the foreclosed home. The way these folks have gotten around the law is to say that, well, I can't sell your home or deed your home back to you or sell it back to you, but I do have this other property over here that I own. I can put you in that. Well, that home over here is not covered under the statute, and therefore they can do the same unscrupulous deal that they couldn't do under the statute because it's not the actual home in foreclosure. So the first thing and primary thing this bill does is close that loophole and say that any property in which the foreclosure purchaser has an interest is covered by the statute. So they just have to follow the rules, provide the disclosures. If the deal fails, the provisions under the bill will go into effect. The second thing the bill does is provide for an automatic stay if the defendant, who is now a renter, is evicted, because that's how these deals work. They get the property deeded over, and the homeowner becomes a renter in a contract for deed or a lease back kind of deal. Well, they structured if they're unscrupulous so that they can't make the payments, and the next action is an eviction. They kick the person out of the home, take the home, take the equity, etc. Well, when we've gone to court to try to stop those evictions because there's been a violation of the existing statute, the housing court judges say, not our jurisdiction. This is a district court action. You go over there and deal with that. My problem is, did you pay the rent? Did you not pay the rent? The answer is no. Get out. And so in the interim, what happens is the defendant goes to court, wins the case, and in the meantime, either that house is sold out from under them, or at best, they're very displaced for several months, and it's a very big hardship. So all we're just going to say is stop the clock until we figure out whether or not there's a violation. And I have to say that every case that's been brought by Mr. Tyson, who will testify after me, who's worked on this for a while, every case we brought, the defendant has won. So they've wound up unwinding the deal and gone back into the house. The third thing it does is clarify who this law applies to and who it doesn't apply to. It was never intended to apply to people who are not in the business of these foreclosure rescues and they have some kind of a personal relationship, a friend or a relative. The current statute is ambiguous around that, and this clarifies that to say you're not covered if you're not in the business of doing this and you know the person you're trying to help. And the final thing it does is remove the 2009 sunset that was placed on the bill in 2004. This statute is a model statute. It's worked just the way it was intended, got the worst offenders out of the business, allowed legitimate transactions to take place, and provides the tools for practitioners to get redress for people who continue to be scammed, and you will hear that this is continuing to take place. Mm-hmm. And finally, this bill was brought forward originally by the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General in conjunction in 2004, and both the AG and the Department of Commerce are fine with the changes we're making. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Elwood, thank you. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mr. Dan Tyson from Best and Flanagan. He's just going to speak briefly.
Mr. Tyson, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah. Senator Pappas, thank you. Dan Tyson from Best and Flanagan. I'm a practicing attorney in real estate and in commercial finance. I've been a pro bono attorney with an organization called Volunteer Lawyers Network, which is located in Hennepin County, one of the oldest and probably one of the best volunteer attorney organizations in the country. And I've been involved with them for nearly 30 years in my career, doing pro bono work in areas relating to housing and in other specific areas. In 1998, we saw the rise of the flipping in our cities and the flipping of homes and the decimation of the neighborhoods as a result of it. We took on some of those cases then, and any cases relating to the fraud of against homeowners that was brought about kind of by the perfect storm of that time when housing values started to increase and the availability of money was plentiful to families and to individuals who would otherwise be credit impaired or unable to get financing. That perfect storm brought about a whole new group of folk, of people who preyed upon people's both emotions, their financial situation, and other in related areas as their homes started to move into foreclosure, and those are the rescue scammers that Ron and Senator Pappas talked about. We find that as we've worked these cases over the last couple of years on behalf of these victims, that these changes to the statute are essential for us to be able to keep going with what we think is going to just the beginning of the surge wave, if you will, using the Katrina kind of analogy of in homeowner foreclosures that are going to be facing many, many people in the city. So with the vision and with the commitment that this legislature made in 2004 in passing the bill in the first place, it has become a model around the country. There's a session at ABA convention coming up in May that will address some of the work that we're doing here in Minnesota and will address this legislation and our legislators' work. We urge you to continue that vision and the commitment to this, to stemming this predatory practice, and look forward to your approval of the bill.
Madam Chair, we're not aware of any opposition. I do have an A1 amendment that does make a slight correction.
Also move the amendment. Yeah.
The A1 amendment.
Mr. Elwood,
it's pretty technical, but it's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Chair, I'll move the bill.
And Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 1533 as amended be recommended to pass. Would this
I think we're told it has to go to judiciary.
Yeah. It'll be referred to judiciary. I'd like to ask Mr. Sexton from the Department of Commerce the department's take on this. And
Madam Chair and members, Pat Sexton from the Department of Commerce. We would view this as a further tightening of good language that we passed in 04.
Thank you very much.
That's what I thought.
And thank you, gentlemen, for, well, Senator Metzen, I wanted to. Senator Metzen knew that without asking. But any further discussion on Senator Pappas's bill here on the Metzen motion? All those, is there anybody else in the audience that would like to say anything concerning this bill? I see none. All those in favor of the Metzen motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The committee will be in recess until 6 o'clock. If you bring your supper, you can sit over here, you know, and eat it. But please don't stay someplace else and eat it unless you're done before 6. So we'll see you, and we'll put in an evening's worth of work. Okay? Thank you very much. We are in recess. Yes.